I'd like to, in some way, describe the most fundamental of the Buddhist teachings. And when the Buddha was asked at some point to give a nutshell summary, some follower said, just sum it up for us. What's a nutshell summary? The Buddha said, cling to no thing whatsoever. Cling to no thing whatsoever, to nothing whatsoever, as I or mine. The Zen masters put it in another way that's quite simple, which is, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. You familiar with that one, some of you? They go on to say, even the smallest clinging or dislike, with even the smallest clinging or dislike, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So we have this message, basically, and sometimes described as the essence of nirvana and freedom, is non-clinging. This kind of releasing that clinging for a glass of water that I was really hoping would be there. Thank you. It's true. I had the sense I was going to get dehydrated, and I knew I wouldn't be all the way here, and part of me was just waiting. That's not being fully present. So it's an important inquiry, really, in the Buddhist tradition, that this not be an abstraction. Okay, that's great. Some enlightened being can just release all clinging, but, you know, we've got our experience of life. But the real wisdom is, I actually like the way Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the teachers from Thailand, put it. He talks about temporary nirvana, that we all have moments where it drops away, this kind of pursuing something else or not liking how it is. We have moments where there's just here-ness, presence. It's what we cherish. It's what we're really longing for. And of course, then the whole parade of wants and fears resurrects itself. But we have moments. And so I'd like to explore really what does it mean to inhabit those moments more. What does it mean to, when we get caught in the trance of pursuing and resisting, to arrive again. And it's kind of like a fist that just relaxes open and discovers the fullness of here. Kurt Vonnegut wrote a little verse in honor of Joe Heller, who wrote Catch 22. He says, true story, word of honor. Joe Heller, an important and funny writer, now dead, and I were at a party given by a billionaire on Shelter Island. I said, Joe, how does it make you feel to know that our host only yesterday may have made more money than your novel Catch-22 has earned in its entire history? And Joe said, I've got something he can never have. And I said, what on earth could that be, Joe? And Joe said, the knowledge that I've got enough. Not bad. Rest in peace. The knowledge that I've got enough. So it's an inquiry, really. How many moments do we really have that sense of enough? That there isn't in some way a leaning forward, kind of waiting, as it said, for the next moment to contain what this moment does not. Moments enough that whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, there's a sense of this is here, fullness. It's okay. So in the first noble truth, many of you have heard of the noble truths. I sometimes like the language, the ennobling truths. It's just the realization of what is that actually wakes us up. In the first noble truth, basically, the understanding is that we humans do not spend much time with that sense of enough, that we are living a lot in discontent, that we spend most moments not feeling at home here. And that it's a universal condition. This isn't our personal problem. This is a universal conditioning to basically want life different. We have major preferences. And they run the show. They're in our DNA. The sense something's missing or something's wrong. It's part of a survival mechanism to be vigilant when it's unpleasant. Something's wrong. Try to get rid of it. When it's pleasant, this is good. Get more of it. It leads to procreation. It leads to thriving. But it's not the end of the story in terms of spiritual awakening. So this is the first noble truth, that we, our sense of identity and beingness has a kind of undercurrent of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. And the second noble truth says it's because we have a perception of being separate. Our sense of who we are, we're living in a story of separate self that needs more of this and doesn't want that. So our identity gets wrapped up in that pursuing and avoiding. That's what keeps fueling this discontent. It's valuable to notice it. I remember at my first retreat, my first Buddhist retreat, I was in my 20s, and I knew inside out what depression was like and anxiety was like and neurosis and not liking myself. And getting to the retreat and having one of the teachers saying, oh, it's universal, the sense of discontent, the sense of whether it's subtle or full-blown anguish, it's universal. And something in me just not taking it so personally, that was the beginning of freedom. So we begin to notice, so how is it? You know, and for it's very clear that we're discontent when stuff really seems to go wrong, you know, when we encounter major pain and loss. But there's the more subtle, not quite where we want to be. There's one Japanese verse, when in Kyoto and the cuckoo sings, I long for Kyoto. It's that feeling. It's like there's something, this longing that's not quite, we're not at home really, fully. And then there's the kind of way that we go around, and I'll speak personally, with a kind of complaint. There's kind of a complaining about how it is and a sense of it shouldn't be this way. And it's like when you're in traffic, there's some sense of it shouldn't be this way. And as one of my friends says, it's like everyone else is traffic. We're driving and everyone else is the traffic. It's just the way we do it, you know. But then there's the more, you know, something's wrong, you know, our contractor's not keeping their promises, or we're angry at our knees for not staying young, or we're impatient in our meditation because we're having a lot of thoughts and we think that's not right. So how it is not okay. I have to read, this is about injustice. This took place in Great Britain. There was a Flying Cross Award, and it was given to Percy the Pigeon. Now listen to this. Who flopped down exhausted in a Sheffield loft, having beaten 1,000 rivals in a 500-mile race, and he was immediately eaten by a cat. The 90-minute delay in finding his remains and handing his identification tag to the judges relegated Percy from first to third place. Injustice, you know. There are many different forms. But there's a sense that it shouldn't be like this. And often we shouldn't be this way. Oh, thank you. Now I really don't have to worry. And then, of course, there's the sense of others should be different. We really think that. That's the dukkha, that it's not the way it's supposed to be. I like the way Barbara Streisand put it. She says, why does a woman work for 10 years to change a man's habits and then complain that he's not the man she married, you know? So basically, bottom line, this ennobling truth is that if we look closely, we'll find we're at war with how it is. There's some argument with how it is. And when we go about living in that mode, we cannot touch those moments of freedom. And what you might do right now is just, I think it's useful sometimes just to check in and sense in your life. You can close your eyes if it helps you. I know sometimes for me I have to close my eyes to sense this. Sense in your life where there's something you're really wanting different. Where there's something that's going on you really don't want happening, or something that you want that you haven't gotten. It might be something to do with your health that you really want different, or something to do with another. Might be to do with money or acquiring something that you want, something you really want to complete, and then you can be okay. Now, let it be really full right here if you need to exaggerate it. Really sense when you're really wanting this or not wanting how it is. Either one's the same. Kind of sense how it is in your body. In fact, if you can, feel with your posture, what does your body do when you're really wanting? Like, just kind of show it to yourself. Like, maybe it's leaning forward, maybe your shoulders change, maybe there's a facial expression. So just, and maybe there's some words going, am I really want such and such, or I really can't stand, or I don't want. But exaggerate it. So that you can sense right now when you're really, when there's clinging, wanting or not wanting, what's your heart like? Can you even feel your heart? Is there a fear? Is there a clutch? What's your mind like? What's your sense of presence of what's right here? When you're really wanting or not wanting something, what's your sense of who you are, of your own being? Whenever you'd like, you can open your eyes. When we can begin to slow down and investigate the state of wanting or not wanting, we begin to sense how cut off we get. How cut off we get from being really awake in our bodies. We're not listening to the sounds that are here. We're not going to be able to enjoy blossoms or smells or feel the breath. Or really pay attention to another person. When there's a story of a self that wants it differently, there's not space or presence for what's here. We're cut off. And we don't really like ourselves. Don't take my word for that. Check that out. But when there's wanting going on, wanting it different, we're not at home with what we are. We become smaller than who we are. Our sense of being shrinks. We don't like ourselves so much. And we think that really our well-being, our refuge, our happiness is somewhere else. That's the bottom line assumption. In any moment of wanting or longing for something out there, the assumption is it's not here, so we don't look here. We don't pay attention here. And that means we miss the one place where we really can find true happiness or freedom. Here. One friend of mine described meditating for many years in the Zen tradition and battling his mind trying to get it to get quiet. He was really wanting to get quiet, and he calls himself a bad meditator. years and years. And then one day, when he kind of hit a real wall, he basically asked himself the question, isn't it true that the silence or quietness I'm wanting isn't already here? It's already here. And then he looked to see and found that it was already here. It wasn't going to be something he could get by getting rid of thoughts. You can't control your way to love or silence or peace. It's already here. All you can do is come back here and inhabit here-ness. So there's a beautiful inquiry here that I've been using a lot, which is, in any moment, isn't it true that what I'm longing for isn't already here? And it's a powerful one. It's a radical inquiry in that it does the trick, because it brings the attention back to the one place where truly what we long for is. Because the silence and the love and the awareness that we long for is what we are. It's only here. So I'll give you an example of how this has been very immediately relevant for me, which has to do with the past week and the peaking of the cherry blossoms. But first I'll ask you, how many of you went out especially to view the cherry blossoms, either Kenwood or the basin or something? How many of you did that this week? Okay, great. Did you have fun? Was it good? Yeah. So there were a couple of days that were like glorious days to do that. Well, my situation is that I love it when they're peaking. I mean, I really love it when they're peaking. And, you know, I kind of want to revel in the glory and not miss out on it, because it just feels like, ah, that's the moment, you know. And this year, it didn't fit into my life to go and view the cherry blossoms. I had other things, such as, in addition to preparing talks for different things, including tonight, my taxes, and I had to go to the dentist and get the preliminaries of a crown put in, and stuff that's not the cherry blossoms, okay? You know, definitely not the cherry blossoms. So here it was peaking, and I was like doing these other things and feeling like I wasn't where I wanted to be. It's like what I was doing was not where the action was at. It was like I was missing out. And so I started noticing the sense of life was passing by. Like, here's the peak of spring. Or like, it's an incredible time. And I was doing, you know, going banking and shopping and doing these things. And so I was realizing that my sense of happiness or well-being was hitched to, you have to be in this place doing this thing. And, you know, banking and shopping bad. Taxes bad. Dental bad. Blossoms good. You know, it was very like that. This is preferences. So so then I just said, okay, I'm going to just take this inquiry. And so I asked myself, so, you know, what is it I'm really longing for? You know, what really am I longing for? And, you know, first I said, well, I want to see beauty. And I'm not going to see the beauty as I'm lying there in the dentist chair with my mouth wide open, you know. But then I went deeper, and it's really feeling the sense of wonder, or feeling a sense of presence, or kind of undivided presence, like completely here for this life. So I said, well, is that not already here? So what I did for those days is I started just asking that question over and over again. And it didn't matter whether I was putting the dishes in the dishwasher, or whether I was going through old bank statements or at my computer, you know, isn't it already here? And the truth is, it really is. And sometimes it's harder to get here to realize that than others. That's why we practice. It was interesting that one night I finally got to go outside, and it was already colder, and the magnolia blossoms were on the ground, and I started thinking, see, they're already down, you know. And I went, wait a minute, this is beautiful. I'm here, beautiful. Now, I have to say, there's a part of me that was going, well, there's always, you know, the dogwood and the redbud. That's a longer season, you know. But the reason I'm sharing this with you is that that inquiry brings us back to the truth that it's here. And then the question is, what about when it's not missing out on the cherry blossoms, but what about when it's our body getting a disease and we might be missing out on being able to walk or move or live, you know, or somebody else is dying and we might miss out on having them on the earth? How do we then use that kind of inquiry and find some peace and presence here? Because that's really why we're on the path. We all, in some way, are trying to find a way to live with this living, dying world and find that happiness and freedom in what's here. So the Buddha's basic message was, in the face of whatever arises, this freedom is possible. It doesn't matter what arises, it's possible to let this refuge of presence reconnect us with awareness and love. It doesn't matter what is happening. And that it's not just for some people that have spent 3 years of retreats in the mountains of Tibet. That any of us, if we're willing to deepen our attention and have sincerity, can discover how in the midst of difficulty, in the midst of craving, in the midst of being at war, how to pause and arrive in the vastness and luminosity of presence. It's right here. So the way he described it was that it's very natural that we go through the seasons. It's like developmentally natural that we go through the seasons of being identified as a separate self and being hitched to, I want it this way and I don't want it that way. That is developmentally the way it is. But it's a developmental arrest if we don't begin seeing that and sensing a larger sense of who we are. So that rather than the separate self that has to have the waves in this direction and doesn't want them in that, we sense ourselves as the ocean. And we have room for the different waves of living and dying, and confusion and depression and excitement and lust and fear. We just have room because it's not a self that's getting battered around. We're larger than that. So meditation is the training that helps us discover that vastness of being that has room for whatever waves arise. That vastness that really has no preferences. That doesn't have to cling because it's all part of our experience. We're the awareness that's experiencing. So the challenge is that we have very strong conditioning. Even as we begin to wake up and have glimmers of, oh, okay, it's just a story of a self and sensing our belonging, there's really strong conditioning that we're working with. And there's a few major flags of discontent that keep re-arising for most of us. One of them is, and this keeps fueling the sense of being a small self. These are the flags, are the signs that are trance is here. We're in trance. One of the signs of the trance, the discontent, speed. If you notice that you're speeding around, you're running away from here-ness. You're trying to get somewhere. The basic assumption is that now's not enough. There's something out there, something different. Speed. I've many times talked about that Chinese syllable. The word for speed is heart-killing. And we can sense it, that when we're rushing around, there's not a tenderness, a receptivity. We can't really hold a space that genuinely connects with others. We're occupied. Speed. That's one of them. The other is the incessant inner dialogue. The sign of discontent, our minds start racing around trying to figure out how to get more of something or avoid something. Watch it. When the mind is really activated, it's a sign of discontent. The major version of the mental activity is judgment. If you find yourself judging, if you find yourself in some way putting down others, that's one of them. I love the way Rita Ridner puts it. She says, my grandmother was a very tough woman. She buried three husbands. Two of them were just napping, you know. So there's this, you know, just discontent. We just try to get rid of what bothers us, you know. There was it's the same when things are not going our way, we definitely lash out with blame. It's like it's part of the organism's design, by the way. When things aren't going okay, we have to determine what's at fault so we can fix it. So we are designed to look for what's wrong with me, what's wrong with you, so we can fix it. But of course we go into overdrive and we're constantly seeing what's wrong. This was a letter that Dear Abby that she received that she didn't know how to answer. Dear Abby, I have a man I can't trust. He cheats so much, I'm not even sure the baby I'm carrying is his. It's a sleeper. So these are the signs of discontent. This is when we're at war with how it is. We speed up. The mind gets very busy. There's a lot of figuring out going on. There's a lot of blaming of ourselves, blaming of other. So how do we undo? Because, you know, meditation isn't about getting ourselves into another state of mind. It's undoing this reactivity so we can arrive at what's already here. And I think that's really important to say, because sometimes we think of meditation as another project. We're going to meditate ourselves into a good state of mind. But what we're really doing is kind of undoing. It's like Swami Satchananda was asked, you know, if you know what it was like to be a Hindu. And he said, well, I don't know if I'm a Hindu, I'm an undo. You know, we're undoing. So, in a way, it's like we're trying to seek tranquility or happiness. And we're doing it. We have this motorboat that's speeding around trying to get somewhere to tranquility or to happiness. But as it speeds around, it's creating a whole lot of noise, announcing itself. Here I am, speeding around, making all sorts of waves, kind of blaming other motorboats that are also making waves for their waves. And it's like, well, how do you use a motorboat to get to tranquility? Well, you throttle back. You can't become still. Stop trying to get somewhere. And the biggest challenge is just to not follow the thoughts. It's like, can we not believe our thoughts? Thoughts are fantastic. They're a fantastic part of being human. But we overthink. So there needs to be that wise discrimination. Let them be our servant, not our master. And have the courage to let go. And it does take courage. Because when we throttle back, when we get quiet, we open to something very unfamiliar in a way. There's kind of a gap in our idea about things. One of my favorite descriptions of working with thoughts comes from Ajahn Sumedho. And he's an American monk that's the head of a monastery in Great Britain. Some of you might remember this. I've shared it here. He says, the practice of letting go is very effective for minds obsessed by compulsive thinking. You simplify your meditation practice down to just two words, letting go. Rather than try to develop this practice and then that and achieve this and go into that and understand this, read the suttas and study the Abhidhamma and then learn Pali and Sanskrit, then the Majjhimakaya and the Prajnaparamita, and get ordinations in Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, write books and become a world-renowned authority on Buddhism. instead of becoming the world's expert on Buddhism and being invited to international Buddhist conferences, just let go, let go, let go. I did nothing but this for about 2 years. Every time I tried to understand or figure out, I'd say, let go, until the desire would fade out. So I'm making it very simple for you to save you from getting caught in incredible amounts of suffering. There's nothing more sorrowful than having to attend international Buddhist conferences. So, and I can attest, it's true. So our predicament, this is the human predicament, and it can go on for decades and decades, and it can go on way after we have sensed ourselves on a spiritual path and begun a meditation practice, because so much of so many spiritual groups and meditation practices have an underlying assumption, like a self-improvement project. We're trying to get somewhere. Any moment we're trying in that motorboat, even if it's a quiet one, trying to get somewhere, we're not arriving in the one place that's really the mystery that's here. So we can spend decades as this kind of anxious self trying to figure out and trying to do it the right way and avoid trouble. And there's a leaning into the future. You can feel it. It's almost like we're tumbling. It's very strong conditioning. So the practices of meditation are really to pause and arrive and be with what's here. And sometimes the question is, you know, really, how can we trust that, you know, because it's a big thing to let go of all that figuring and judging and evaluating and trying and just say, okay, be here. It's like the biggest, most challenging, most courageous thing we could do. You know that T.S. Eliot line, I think it goes, here, now, always, a moment of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. It's like we have to give up everything. Our whole sense of our story of ourself, and just say, okay, a dedicated presence here. I'll give you an example of someone I worked with that used a similar kind of inquiry as I described for myself with cherry blossoms, but in a much more disturbing situation. And hers was, and this was a meditation student here, that her marriage had broken up. And it was in a very bitter way, and she had major tension with her eldest son, who was 18. And she was tensing against more loss. You know, there was the custody battle for her daughter, and she had her own health issues with blood pressure and diabetes and weight, and so she had the sense that her life was going wrong on every front. And she was very defensive and angry and blaming. Just all the stuff that we get in when we're stressed and feel victimized. So that was her story. My life isn't working out. And it's my fault and it's his fault and, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of our practice was that she'd be telling me what was going wrong, and we just would periodically, and she agreed on it, I wasn't imposing the pause, but we'd periodically say, okay, let's stop here. And by the way, this I call the sacred art of pausing is the beginning of undoing. If you want to undo the conditioning of this self that's grasping and avoiding, pause. So we'd pause. And as she kind of got the knack of it, the pausing really was about pausing and saying, okay, let go of the story of blame. There's no victim. There's nobody that's causing trouble. You know, just there's nothing you have to do. Just what's happening here? That's the inquiry. What's happening? And she initially would get in touch with fear, fear that she realized everything that she was doing is running away from this clutch of fear. Everything, all the blaming, all the defending. She didn't want to feel that. And all of us know, if we've gotten intimate with fear, it's the place we don't want to be. So there was a clutch of fear, and so we practiced staying there together. Fear, fear, just naming it, and just feeling, kind of breathing with it. And it really helps, and I've mentioned here many times, if you can put your hand on your own heart and breathe with what's there, it's like there's a kindness and a presence that allows you to stay, which is really the essence. Can we stay? Because everything in our conditioning is to leave. So we stay. So she stayed. And when she could really stay, underneath that clutch of fear was an enormous amount of grief. It was the sense of loss. And it wasn't just the loss of her husband. It was the ocean of sorrows. In fact, she just was contacting the feeling of losing her son and losing her daughter and losing her friends. It was like the death of everything she loved was being processed in that grieving. And so she had to grieve for a number of months. But what she started reporting was that when she was using the inquiry, isn't what I'm longing for already here? She found in the grief there was a longing for love, which is that grief is loss of connection. And the longing under grief, love. So she started just saying, isn't it already here? Isn't it already here? And she found more and more when she let herself grieve. When she let herself inhabit or let go into brokenheartedness, there was an openheartedness and tenderness that was the space it was all happening in. Isn't the love already here? It's an amazingly powerful inquiry. But the answer can quickly be, no, I feel terrible, unless we stay here. So that was her practice, was staying here, and discovering that space of loving, that cherishing. Like, she had to face the death, the grief, to really experience the cherishing. And what she came out with, she described it, she said that by letting myself grieve like that, this divorce has really been a kind of soul retrieval. Some of you might be familiar with that language. She felt like I got back my soul because I went right into that grief. I got back that kind of a timeless love. If we hitch our love, our wants, to anything, the cherry blossoms peaking, this body being healthy, somebody that we love staying alive, anything we hitch ourselves to, that's going to come and go. But if we can open to the sadness about that, and then feel that openness, we contact a love that can't be taken away. This is a poem I love by David White that I share a lot because I think it's so good. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, we'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. So it becomes revealing if we notice how much we're wishing for something else. We're wanting life to be different. And whether we come back here into the well of grief, our fear, our kind of an excitement, our depression, whatever it is that's here, if we open to it, what we discover is openness. If we're aware of it, what we discover is awareness. If we're opening kindly, we discover kindness. We discover the very thing we want. Awakeness, openness, kindness, presence. There's a fear I want to mention about this practice of saying, isn't it already here? Let go of clinging, open to what's here. And the fear is that if we open to what's here, we won't try to change the things in the world that need changing, that we'll be passive, that we won't really care. You know, non-clinging can seem like this cold, aloof, disconnected place. And yet, in actuality, it's the very essence of the bodhisattva path, the path of the awakening being, that when we're here now, that becomes the grounds of compassionate action. It's only when we're really here that we can let the sorrows of the world touch our heart. Otherwise, it's an abstract caring. And we'll act, but we'll act in a reactive way. Out of our anger, our fear, our ideas of justice, which just plant the seeds of more violence, more greed. So it's really this fully arriving, finding what we long for here, this presence that then allows us in a really spontaneous way, in a deeply caring way, to respond to what's in the world. Presence isn't passive. But there is a kind of pausing and arriving that reconnects us with the wisdom and with the aliveness and the care. So maybe we'll close, I'm thinking, with a final meditation. Yeah, let's do that. Just find a way of sitting that feels comfortable and good to you. And let this be a pause. Your senses awake right here. And much as we did earlier, you might sense that inquiry, so what do I long for? This is a real sincere kind of checking in. What is it that really matters to you? What is the experience? The quality of awareness? And is it not true that it's already here in the here-ness? In this very moment. Just with an open mind and heart, sense how that might be possible. Letting go of ideas and thoughts. Awake, aware of the experiences of sound and sensation, aware of the field of presence that's knowing the sounds. The sensations. Open and awake. Is it not true that what you long for is already here? Is it not true that what you long for is really what you are? Awareness realizing itself through these bodies and minds. This is a poem by Kabir. He says, I've been thinking of the difference between water and the waves on it. Rising, water still water. Falling back, it is water. Will you give me a hint how to tell them apart? Because someone has made up the word wave, do I have to distinguish it from water? There is a secret one inside us. The planets in all the galaxies pass through his hands like beads. That is a string of beads one should look at with luminous eyes. There is a secret one inside us. The planets and all the galaxies pass through his hands like beads. That is a string of beads one should look at with luminous eyes. May all beings realize the loving presence that is our essence. May all beings realize and inhabit that love, that there be peace on earth, that there be peace everywhere. May all beings awaken and be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.